Welcome to another episode of Living Your Sparked Second Half. Today's guest, Mary Jo Hoffman, is an artist and photographer renowned for her unique and personal engagement with the natural world around her. She's best known for her multi-year ongoing project, Still, where every day for over a decade, she's made a photograph of nature. No subject too small or ordinary. So for Mary Jo, a former aeronautical engineer, this daily ritual cracked open profound revelations about the connectedness of all things, the importance of place, and her own life. She lives in Minnesota with her husband, Steve, and he's a food writer and author, and her puggle, Jack, her 16-year-old puggle, who she takes on walks as often as possible because she's always on the hunt for that day's still subject. She's coming out with a book called Still, The Art of Noticing. It features 275 of the most stunning photographs that she's accumulated over thousands of consecutive days of daily shooting, accompanied by perceptive, deeply felt, and oftentimes humorous essays, illuminating the insights gained through this daily creative practice that she has committed herself to. It's going to be released in May. You can pre-order it. So without further ado, let's get to the episode and you can meet Mary Jo and be inspired by her story. Today, I am excited to talk to Mary Jo because she has an interesting backstory about what she did before and what she's doing now. And what she's doing now is very creative. And I think creativity is something we could all do a little more of and we neglect. And so I'm excited to have you here to share all about your life and how you got on this path. It's always intriguing to my audience to hear these stories like yours. So welcome.
Thanks, Lori. Thank you. I'm absolutely delighted to be here. I'm thrilled.
Yes. And Mary Jo is in a snowstorm in Minnesota. I'm so glad I don't. We are not having any more snow. Yeah. So you're in Virginia. So yes, like I was saying before I hit record, when I got the summary of what you do, and you just did a book about, and a lot of people write books, but your book is different because it's about your creativity. Yes. It's your book of a collection of photos, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's an art book. It's like a coffee table book. Oh. But I got to write as much as I want. I wrote six personal essays. So it's a 320-page book, but I think my essays added up to about 60 pages. Anyways, it's a beautiful book. It's a gorgeous book.
So are the photos embedded in the essay?
The essays kind of stand alone at the beginning of sort of each section of the book. There's text, and then there's a dozen or two dozen full bleed pages of artwork. So it's really an art book, a coffee table art book. It's published by Monticelli Fiden. Fiden's the biggest art book publisher in the world. And so it is available worldwide, which is thrilling for me.
Has it come out yet?
It is pre-orders right now.
Pre-orders. Okay.
And I know the people that ordered through the publisher, direct from the publisher, are just starting to receive them. Most people order through like Amazon or whatever, Barnes and Noble, and the official pub day is May 1st. But I'm quite certain they'll arrive early.
Okay, sounds like a good Christmas gift for
Mother's Day gift.
Mother's Day. There's lots of occasions that you could have, Mother's and Father's Day. Yeah. So let's start, because your story is very interesting. And are you okay with me saying your age?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So you're 59. 59. I know you're going to be 60 soon, but I don't want you to age yourself before you just every single day before you turn 60.
All right. Say, I'm 59. I've been aging myself for 2 years. I'm the youngest of all my friends. And so I just say whatever age they are, because we're all about the same age. And so I've been aging myself for years. But anyway, yeah.
So big birthday.
I turned 60 in May.
Yes. And you started on this journey of creativity in your 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And
40s.
Yep. Yeah. And it sounds like your husband was on a similar path of wanting to be more creative.
Yeah. Yeah. So we met when, should I tell my whole story?
Yeah, I want to hear.
So we met when, well, we married young. I mean, not so young for our generation. He was 23. I was 25 when we got married. And so we've been married 34 years. And we both had creative ambitions. I was back then a pretty good amateur photographer. But I also did what I would later start to call visual journaling. I love collage. I do a lot of collage work. So all visual arts. And Steve was a writer and wanted to be a writer, ambitions to be a writer, wrote poetry.
But these were hobbies?
These were sort of hobbies. He tried to do writing full time as a young man. So anyway, what happened is I was, I don't know, unnaturally gifted in mathematics. I don't know where it came from.
I didn't get that gene.
Nobody in my family did either. It's the craziest thing. Anyways, what happened is it made high school and college incredibly easy and fun because I ended up taking mostly math and science. And at some point, anyone who studied math and science, physics is really just mathematics. At some point, it's all based on math. And I was good at math. So I went into engineering. I picked aerospace engineering because it was the most mathematics, honestly. And, you know, if you think about orbital mechanics and things floating in three-dimensional space, and it's all mathematics. And so
I have a question. Not to interrupt, but it came up because you think, or I think the general public thinks that math and creativity are opposite ends of the spectrum.
Oh, no. Yeah. It's maybe like a circle where they ended up connecting at some point. I worked in research. So most of my colleagues were PhDs and all of them were creative, had creative outlets, creative passions. The connection between like math and music is super well
documented. Yes, that's, I was going to say that.
If you think about it, mathematics is a form of abstraction. Right. It's just a form of abstraction. And a lot of the arts are too.
Yeah. So languages, I think, too. Computer programming, a lot of the computer programmers played instruments. And I was like,
a lot of engineers, everybody thinks they're nerdy, but they're super creative. So I think they go hand in hand. I think that's been pretty well documented. I should look into it because I get asked that question a lot. And I should look into what they think the explanation is. For me, it's this idea of abstraction, even just comfort with abstraction, but it could be like a facility with abstraction, abstract thinking. Mm-hmm. So anyways, yes, it's a very common for mathematicians and by extension.
So it wasn't so unusual that this aerospace engineer had this love of photography.
No, I don't think so. I don't know how many engineers go into visual arts because that is kind of a left brain, right brain thing. So maybe that's a little bit more unusual. But anyway, I put myself through college. I had to get a job out of college. I was very good at mathematics, which made the whole engineering core curriculum very easy for me and also made it very easy to get a job when I got out of school. And so I followed engineering because I was good at it and it was practical. Not because I
felt probably good income too.
Absolutely. Super. Mm-hmm. I mean, I made a very good professional income right out of school. And I had 8 job interviews when I graduated college and I had 8 offers.
Wow.
That was back in the Reagan era. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of aerospace. We were doing the whole Cold War run up and there was a lot of research monies for aerospace. Anyways, and I enjoyed it because I was good at it, but it was never necessarily a calling. And I always harbored these sort of creative hobbies. I don't know that I had ambitions to turn them into more than that, I had desires to have more time to explore them. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I love doing them. I loved my creative practices, my creative hobbies, and that's what I did with all my free time. Anyways, so, and my husband was similar. He studied languages. He studied literature in school. He is a French, speaks French fluently.
Did you meet in college?
We met right after the summer I graduated from college. We went to two different colleges. Yeah.
And it sounds like you didn't have kids, or do you have children?
We have two kids.
Oh, you do have two kids. Okay.
Yeah. So we married
child rearing, and you had that hobby.
Well, yeah, I know. So this is kind of interesting because we got married when I was 25, but we didn't have kids for 10 years.
Okay.
And we weren't sure we wanted kids. We were traveling the world. We had a big professional income, having too much fun, wasn't sure. And then of course, as happens, you get to those into your 30s and you think, yes, this is something that we would like to do. And so at some point, my husband and I switched. I was the primary breadwinner. We switched roles. He became the breadwinner. And then we have two kids. They're now 25 and 20. So what happened is when the kids, and then we were heads down, raising kids, paying mortgages, the whole thing. And when the kids went to a public school here called French Immersion School, I'm sure you have them in Virginia too. And as a public school, when they got elementary and when they got out, they could read and hear and understand French, but they didn't really speak French. So I thought I wanted them to be fluent. So after driving them across town for French immersion school for that many years, I wanted them to be more than just understand French. And so my husband's work is seasonal. He's a tax preparer. It's tax season right now. And we decided to relocate to Southern France and put the kids in a village school.
That is amazing.
Yeah. And so they were, I think our son was 9. Our daughter was like 13. So we did that. And
not many parents would do that, wouldn't uproot their kids like that. I love that you are so committed to another language.
Yeah.
I wished I had learned another. I mean, I learned Spanish, but again, like they do in school, you can do the schoolwork, but you can't go out into the world and interact with people.
Right. I wanted them to speak French, but I also wanted them to know we live in the suburban Twin Cities. I mean, it's very quiet. It's very mainstream. It's very quiet. It's whatever. And I wanted them to know the bigger world.
Kind of vanilla.
Yeah, it's very vanilla. And I wanted them to know that the world was bigger and that I wanted them to know they could feel comfortable, right? Mm-hmm. Beyond our very prescribed home environment. So it was a calculated, there was a lot of thought behind doing that because I had shy kids. I had sensitive, shy kids. And so it was a kind of a gamble, right? Mm-hmm. I wasn't taking two extroverts and throwing them in the school. Southern France. I was asking shy kids to do this very uncomfortable thing, but then we ended up falling in love with it. And that's another story. But while we were there that first time, we ended up going back and forth for the next 12 years. But while we were there the first time, it was the first time we had shut down all of our work at home and handed it off and hired people to oversee things and take care of the house and all that kind of stuff. We brought the dog with us. And so it was the first time when the kids went to school, and the French school system is 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. And typically the kids come home for a 1-hour lunch, but half of them stay for lunch. And we actually wanted our kids to stay for lunch because so they would talk to their classmates.
Right.
Even though Steve and I were free and we could have had them home for lunch.
Yeah, but they would come home and talk English.
But they would talk English. So we had them stay. So suddenly, Steve, for the first time in our lives, since, you know, we have 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. free and the kids are in school and we've put all of our businesses to rest for the semester. So we said to each other, I was reading a lot at that point. Of course, it's our mid-40s about personal finance. You know, and one of the recommendations we saw is that you need to practice for retirement. Mm. And it was an interesting idea. And it was about the people, you know, it was advice for the people that work, 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 and then retire and then look up one day and they have no community, no interests, no hobbies. Their whole life was about work. And so it was
a lot of people, I find, avoid retirement because even if they don't like their job, they want to stay in it because they don't know what they're going to do.
Yeah. What they do. And my husband's a tax preparer. He sees it all the time. It's very, very common, especially with men. It's incredibly common. So we read this advice, practice for retirement. So I said to Steve, let's practice for retirement. And well, we're in France because we have this 9 to 5, 9 to 4. And so we did. And he started writing every morning. And I was at that time, it was when blogs were big. And I had found an online community of people who were all artists sharing work. And it just looked fun. They were all supporting each other. And it just looked like a fun community. And I thought, well, I want to be part of that community. And you could participate in that community one of two ways. You could either make work and share it. So you could be a creator, or you could be a curator, right? So you could find art you liked and create a blog and share it with people and give people recognition and whatever. And I decided I want to be a creator. I want to participate.
So it's kind of like displaying. You kind of like a curator is almost like a gallery owner. But it's a website of some sort.
Right.
So highlighting other people's work.
People, those blogs, if you will, or Substacks now, they exist still. People that are into fashion or into whatever, and they curate or find, good examples to share. So I wanted to be...
Was this a French community? Were these people speaking French or were they English speaking?
I was in France, but I was mostly watching American artists. It was actually very... Now I take that back. It was an international, but it was all in English.
Okay.
It is interesting when you're in a foreign country, you probably know this, and you Google something, your Google search results are different based on the location of your search. So you will get, if you Google like artists, visual artists or whatever, you'll get 10 different answers than if you do it from an American IP address.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah. So that's
even though it's still in English, because it's still in your preferred language.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, it doesn't surprise me.
Anyway, let's practice for retirement. And so I decided that I was going to do, I'd been a good hobbyist photographer. I had my camera there in France. Our whole family is nature lovers. We're all nature lovers, and we hike, and we had the dog, and we have to walk the dog every day because he's a puggle.
Yes. People,
the beagle she has a puggle.
I love puggles. Puggles
with
are
a daily walk. Yeah.
If Harry Potter had a dog, I think it would be a puggle, because I always think of that because of muggles.
That's really funny. That's really funny. That would be funny. Anyway, I decided that after much thought and brainstorming, I would do a photo a day of found nature, from my daily walks, and I would photograph it and share it to a blog. And I called the blog Still, like Still Life, or Take a Moment to Be Still, Look at One Thing at a Time kind of thing.
And would you take a few pictures and then pick your favorite?
I always post one image a day. Yes, I do. I often edit two or three and then put it away for an hour and then come back and pick the one I'm going to post.
And
one a day.
What did you allow your intuition to pull you to something?
The subjects?
Yeah. How do you pick? I mean, when you walk outside, there's a zillion things you could pick.
Right. Well, first of all, I started on January 1st in Minnesota. I don't know why. In my mind, so I committed to a one-a-day, one-year project. I'm going to do one photo a day for 1 year. That was my project. And I, for some reason, picked a calendar year. Minnesota in January, I mean, really, there's nothing to pick from. So the problem when I started was not an overabundance of subjects. But
that's true.
Anyways, that is, I just got back from California and I gave a workshop. I said to them, I don't think I could do my project here. There is so much to choose from. It would be like decision fatigue. I probably would adjust in 3 months, but it would take me a 3 full months to adjust.
That's interesting. Yeah. Cause I guess if you have a lot of snow, then it's like whatever sticking out of the snow is the subject.
If you look at my pictures from truly my January, February, March pictures, it's twigs, it's winter stems, it's dried seed pods, it's branches. It's very, very spare. I happen to be a minimalist. So those spare, very spare photos of brown and gray subjects on a white background actually speak to me. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot about negative space and that kind of thing. So anyway, I lost track where we were, what you're talking about.
You're talking about you committed to doing one photo a day.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. And so Steve started writing in the morning, and what happened is these were just practicing for retirement. So now we're in our mid 40s, right? And the thought was that we would retire in our late 50s. And then what happened is we fell in love with this village and kept going back and forth for the next 12 years. And of course, now retirement's pushed off somewhat indefinitely. It's not going to happen in our late 50s, but that's fine.
But you're no longer an aerospace. When did you stop being an aerospace engineer? When you made the decision to go to France?
Right before I went to France.
So you kind of retired from that career.
I did retire from that career. Mm-hmm. I did. And so the kids are in school. Now we have time. Let's do these. Let's practice for retirement, which is picking up these hobbies we've always dabbled in it, but never had time to do thoroughly. And what happened is Steve started writing, I started doing still. And within a year, both projects got traction. And traction's a funny word, but within 6 months, Martha Stewart Living magazine had called me wanted to do a feature. Yeah. And then within a year, Steve had written, he had written three pieces for our the Minneapolis Star Tribune newspaper, our local newspaper, and they won a food writing award.
Oh.
So suddenly we had these hobbies that were turning into more than hobbies. And so we just kept going and we just kept going. So that's how it started. And now Steve has a book coming out on July 9th. Memoir about us putting the kids in school and going down to that French village. And
his first book?
It is. He's done a lot of articles. He writes a lot for magazines and newspapers. He's a food writer. Mm-hmm. He's won the James Beard Award for food writing.
So is he somebody who goes and tastes food and then?
No, not a critic. Not a critic. No, okay. His writing is very like personal essay, telling stories through food.
Okay. Got it.
The book that comes out in July is a memoir.
We'll have to put that in the show notes too. We'll link up to both of your books. Because somebody might have an interest in what he did with what that journey was like.
I think his book will do quite well. People will see it's called A Season for That. And the interesting thing is because it's a memoir about this period in France, I'm doing still this project throughout the whole memoir. And my book that comes out in May is called Still the Art of Noticing. And it's about this project. So the two books are, one's a coffee table art book and one's a memoir, but they're completely complementary. He's writing about me doing still. And I have a lot of photos that I took while I was in France in the coffee table book. So they're very complementary. So
How'd you pick the pictures that must have been hard, like picking children or something?
It's terrible. So I've been doing a photo a day every day for 12 years. I haven't stopped. And we're going to talk about dailiness because I want to give you a challenge for you said you wanted to start painting. Mm-hmm. So we should talk about dailiness. But yeah, I've been doing it every day for 12 years, which means I have over 4,000 images. And yes, I had to pick, there's 275 images in the book. And it was sort of impossible. What I ended up doing is writing the essays first. I could have picked the photos and then written the essays. But what I did is I wrote the essays and then picked the photos that illustrate the essays. Not illustrate, but in my sense, make sense with those essays.
Yeah, yeah. I was thinking that might have made it easier.
Yeah, It was nearly impossible.
Yeah.
And a lot of my, not a lot, maybe a dozen of some of my favorite photos didn't make it in the book, which is interesting because they just didn't fit that essay. You know, the essays were about different topics. So, yeah. But that's okay. I'm very proud of the book and it's beautiful. So
I bet it turned out
great. But it was nearly
how big
impossible.
Is it? Because I know coffee table books have different sizes.
Yeah, it is. Well, it's 8¾ by 10½. It's a nice sized coffee table book.
Okay.
And I'm looking around my table here while we talk because
I just made my first coffee table book.
You did
in Shutterfly.
Oh sure, sure. I used to do that. No, years ago.
It's a gift for some people that invited us to their castle in Scotland. Perfect. And so I put pictures in it, and it's very obviously elementary. But I can see how that could be so thrilling. But it does the image, and whether it's landscape or portrait or what's on the page, and unless you're doing one picture per page. There's a lot of design work and I think creativity that has to go into how the book's going to look on a page.
Yeah, I had a designer. So my publisher hired a designer to do the layout. So I wrote the essays and they're my images. And then the editor, the designer and I worked really closely for about 6-9 months to design the book.
Yeah, that's so neat.
And it was, thank God I had a designer because I couldn't have done what she did. No way.
That's what you realize when you, and you hope you get your money's worth and then you realize you did when something like that. Yeah. One of the things that I mentioned to you before we hit record was that I had done a photography class, like an iPhone photography, basic photography course. And I've never had any, like even in high school when you could pick these art classes, you know, you could one semester or whatever in college, I never did anything with art or how to compose something. And because there's a lot of position and how you position stuff. And so I just thought, this will be interesting. And I'll learn how to use the features on my iPhone better. And what I didn't realize is how much, and it sounds like you're a nature lover. I will say that I am a nature lover when I pay attention. But normally I am going about my business in a hectic and, you know, hustle bustle way. And I never stop to smell the roses. There's a reason for that saying. And so I really noticed when I was starting to take pictures for this course that I looked through my lens differently. It was a totally different feeling of what was there, what that was. And it's just so funny because I'd be taking pictures of kind of the same things that I would take. I'm going on a walk with my dog and I'm taking a picture of the sunset. In the process of taking the picture, I just felt so much closer to nature. Than I ever had felt.
Because people think, you know, when you're taking a picture, you're kind of one step removed, you're behind the screen. But when you're taking a picture with full intention, so you're fully present. You're fully present, you're focused on that subject, and you're thinking about elements of composition. I'm sure you learned about rule of thirds in your photography class.
That's so interesting.
You know, you're looking at all the edges of the frame and making sure you only have in the photo what you want and nothing else. And that intentionality, that hyper-focus, I would say, that attentiveness it does something that makes those moments, I think I would say they get written in Sharpie in the memory. They become indelible. But yeah, I have the same experience when I make my photos too. Once I spend enough time with a subject, you know, whether it's milkweed pods, for example, and which is, I shoot on a white background, so it's very hard because that fluff is white and it's very tricky. But I can tell you almost, I have 4,000 images in my portfolio. I can tell you where almost every one of those subjects was found. Because I'm so in the moment, I'm so present, I'm so focused when I find those subjects that it gets written in memory, you know? Yeah. So it's an interesting thing.
It's like giving birth to your picture, you know, where you gave well, birth to it.
You're creating little babies. I'm just doing them every day.
But it's so interesting. It's so interesting what you said, because you think you're present when you're taking a picture, but you're really not. Your mind isn't there. Mm-mm. Your mind is on, oh, I've got to do this because, or you're thinking about the next thing. And it's so true that you're really in that moment.
You're in the moment. You're present. So one of the things, and this is why this project of taking a photo a day is it's extraordinary. It's been 12 plus years. I haven't missed a day. There's some craziness involved in that. A certain level of commitment that people find fascinating. But what happened is that being present like that every day, it became essentially a mindfulness practice, right? Mindfulness is about being present. The only difference is, you know, when you do meditation or breath work, it's an inner focus. And I have the same level of presentness. It's just an outward focus on nature. But it's every bit a mindfulness practice. And so what happened is I did that first year. It got traction. It got some magazine press. But, you know, that kind of slowly went away after a while. And then what happened is I didn't want to stop. This is so life affirming. It's such a positive way to live in the world, to be this present. And you can't be present all the time. Our brains aren't big enough to take in everything all the time in that kind of hyper vigilance. But to be that kind of present for 5 minutes, 10 minutes a day, while I look for my still subject, or that, I can do that. And it's a wonderful way to live in the world. I just happen to pick nature, but you could do it really with anything.
So it was all is outside. Because I guess nature is outside. There's not inside nature. I think of a houseplant. Is that?
I believe me. March, because March in Minnesota is brutal. We're all ready for spring, and it's not spring by any means. And so I start photographing the houseplants for sure.
Okay.
So I let myself off the hook from time to time. I also, after a couple of years of doing so many brown twigs in January and February, I started drying plants in, you know, hanging flowers upside down and drying them. And then I will allow myself to play with those in the off season too, you know.
Yeah. And there's beautiful pictures of fruits.
I did a whole series of cut up fruits and vegetables, which people loved. It was labor intensive the way I did it. It's very stylized. I happen to have just posted some on Instagram if people are curious, but I used a mandolin. Mm-hmm. And so I did these very very, very thin slices.
Oh, wow. I cut myself bad on one of those.
Oh, my husband did too. We went to the ER for the mandolin.
I was thinking, is that the thing that,
He walked in with the paper towel wad around his thumb, and the ER doc just laughed and said, mandolin, right? Right away. Anyway, yes.
So I have a couple questions.
Yeah, go ahead.
And let me ask them both at the same time, and because I might forget one. So first of all, did you do it the same time every day? And secondly, did you ever feel like it was a grind? Did you ever kind of feel like, oh my God, what did I commit to?
Yeah, good questions. No, I don't do it at the same time every day, but I have, you know, I've been doing it a long time. And so I've evolved into a routine that works for me. So I want to have my subject identified by late morning. And then I actually like it to sit on the kitchen couch. I photograph on my kitchen floor because I happen to have big picture windows and skylights in there. So I use natural lighting. So I just happen to have good lighting. It's the best lighting in the house. So that's why I photograph. So I like it to kind of sit my subject, whatever it is, to sit on the kitchen counter for a little bit. So I can just do that subconscious thing where I can think about how I might want to photograph it. And then, so I have it sitting on the kitchen counter by, you know, 11 o'clock in the morning, and sometime around 2-3 in the afternoon, I will make a photo. So I will arrange it. I have rules, no man-made nothing man-made in the photo. It's just the subject, minimally manipulated, but I do crush, I will tear, I will open, I will fold, but nothing man-made in the subject. And then I make my arrangement. Sometimes it's just a profile of a subject, but when I have more time, on days I have more time, I'll make a composition or an arrangement. I call them assemblage, an assemblage.
And then, there's your French.
Yeah, I know. I didn't mean to do that. That came I'm sorry. That was so pretentious. And that's the word in my head. And it just came out.
Well, it shows you spent several years there.
Anyway, and then I make my photo about 2-3 in the afternoon. And then usually around dinner time, I edit my photo because my husband is a food writer and likes to cook.
You're lucky you.
I know. I was the home cook for 20 years, but he came to food writing late. Now he's all about food and he does the cooking. So then I edit the photo and then I post it around 9 o'clock at night before I go to bed, and so that it refreshes overnight on the blog. Mm-hmm. And, you know, each of those increments, here's the thing, that this is important, because if you're going to do one of these one a day assignments, which I'm going to encourage you to do, I'm going to challenge you to do, is that each of those increments I can do in a matter of minutes if I have to, right? Yeah. So if the day is busy, I find a surprising number of my subjects on the edges of parking lots. And I do the grocery shopping, I see something on the edge of a parking lot, and it's on my kitchen counter, then I make, the photo making is actually the easiest and swiftest part. Once I've decided how I'm going to arrange. The composition part's actually still one of the more challenging parts. And then the editing, I can do very swiftly if I'm busy. And if I'm less busy, I enjoy the editing process and I can kind of, I will play with a single image for up to 20 minutes. But if I have to, I can do it in 2 minutes. And then the posting just takes another 3 or 4 minutes before bed.
And your commitment was to put it on your blog. So that was, you know, in terms of when you say commit to a daily thing, it seems like there's a process by which when you make a commitment, is that it's kind of like the accountability part of it, right?
Bingo. That's this. So what happened is when I was in France, so that I was conceiving of the project, what happened is I saw a meme. We didn't call them memes in 2010. It was by Austin Kleon, famous writer about creativity. And it said he had 10 secrets for art, for creatives. And like one of them was do good work and put it where people can see it. Mm. And I realized I had all these journals. I had a hard drive full of photos and nobody could see them.
Ah.
So that's how I decided to do this, put it on a blog thing. It was, you know, put it where people can see it. That was pre-Instagram, that, you know, I think Instagram, well, it wasn't, Instagram was just starting, but I wasn't on it. So anyways, that was the idea, put it where people can see it, but that's what the putting where people can see it. That's what it is about accountability. So like when you do your painting challenge, mm-hmm. your 30 day painting challenge, are we going to do 30 days or 100 days?
Oh, so yeah. So I did. And that's a good question, because to me, and I wonder how much this happens to people, my brain starts to go, well, I have to do this because I don't have this. I don't have training. So I need to take a course first before I start painting. Mm-mm. And oh, I have to do a picture, and a picture will take me more than one day. So like, where do you draw the line that says this is all you need to do?
So yes, we're going to design your dailiness project. Right. Okay. Now. You're going to do 100 day.
Okay.
Painting a day.
And my listeners, if somebody's listening out there to this, they have to commit to doing it too, right?
Yeah, there you go. And what you're going to do is you're going to commit and you're going to use like a 4x6 note card or like a 3x5. I think you can buy pads of those watercolor paper.
Yeah, they're smaller.
In the 4x6, like the postcard size. Because we don't want it. We don't want it to be intimidating.
Yeah.
You're going to buy 100 of those. And then are you going to work in acrylic or watercolors?
I have watercolors.
Okay, perfect. And so all you're going to commit to is 100 paintings a day. And you could decide whether it's part of a morning routine, an afternoon. But here's the deal. However you define the project, it has to be met. Like for me, on a busy day, a really, really busy day, and life happens. I mean, my mom's 88 and I'm the primary, and I spend many days now in, you know, in ERs, but I still make my photos because I can not break my chain. I can meet my commitment by just holding a leaf in front of a white t-shirt or in front of a white wall and taking a photo.
Mm.
So it's just found nature on a white background. And so define your project. So on those days that get super busy, if all you do is wet your paintbrush and make three dabs on the paint on the paper, you've met your criteria for the day and you haven't broken the chain.
Mm.
And so what you're going to do is commit to not breaking the chain for 100 days.
Mm.
So what happens is not breaking the chain is more important than the product.
Yeah.
But what you'll find at after 100 days is that there will be 10 of those that are really good. Mm. And suddenly you have 10 good paintings after 3 months that you probably wouldn't have made otherwise.
Mm.
So by focusing on not breaking the chain, you're taking away the perfectionism.
Yes.
You're taking away the procrastination.
Mm-hmm.
You're lowering the stakes. Like if all I need to do is wet my brush and put three dabs of color on there, or wet the paper and let the three dabs of color bleed into each other and see what happens,
mm-hmm.
that meets the criteria. So there you go. By focusing on that, not breaking the chain, you've taken away a lot of the hurdles that people get stuck with.
I think
procrastination, perfectionism, all of those things, the inner critic, you would normally say to yourself, oh, this is a stupid painting. I'm not, you know, nope. The more important thing is that you not break the chain, and it really helps to have some accountability. So have a friend or an Instagram account or Facebook account so that you're committed to sharing that with your daughter. I know you're close to your daughter, and just say, hold me accountable. I'm going to do a photo a day, or, you know, a painting a day. But so that's my advice to you. Just commit to 100 days. Don't break the chain. Make it simple. Make meeting your commitment doable in its simplest form.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And then,
what came up for me? What came up for me is you don't have to have a finished picture every day.
No.
You just have to, and that's what resonated with me when you said just three dots. You can have a 100-day goal of a finished product, and maybe by 100 days you have three finished products, but your commitment is to making progress on
your commitment is to not breaking the chain.
And you could take a picture each day and then over time, it's like a time-lapse photo in the end. Right.
Or you can, you know, if you don't want to share the in-process photos, share it with your daughter, have somebody hold you accountable.
Right.
And then, but then show your 10 best at the end of the project and say, I just completed my 100-day challenge. You know what
I mean? Like you said, the 100 might turn into 200 to
4,000.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, for me, it became a mindfulness practice. Once you lower the stakes, once you just make it play and fun, and that the only commitment you have is to not break the chain, you're not committing to making fine art. You're not committing to even improving, mm-hmm. but you will improve, but you're not committing to that.
Yeah.
You're committing to not breaking the chain. Then it becomes fun, because the not breaking the chain is easy to do.
Yeah.
And then that allows you to have, you know, play with the rest.
Yeah.
It reminds me. You're going to have fun, and I can't wait to see what you do.
Yeah, it reminds me of one of my students who started writing 10 minutes a day and now has written, I mean, she's on her second book series. So the first was a 5-book series, and I think a sixth. She had a holiday book, so it was ultimately a 6-book series, and now she's, I think, writing the 4th book of her second book series. Yeah, and it started as a 10-minute not breaking the chain.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, so many artists, when you read, a lot of artists end up writing about the creative process later in life, and everybody winds their way to the same conclusions. The process is more sacred than the results.
Yeah.
The results you put in the world and the world does with it what you will, and it mm-hmm. doesn't matter, but the process is sacred. And the process for me, not only is not breaking the chain, lower the stakes and makes turns that work into play, but it also, it puts me in a state of being that is life affirming by focusing on the process and not on the product. So anyways, it's very powerful. It's so simple and extremely powerful.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that.
I'm actually excited for you.
Yeah.
Because it's so
I didn't know this was going
to
be a challenge, but I'm up for it. Yeah. Because, you know, I find myself creating these hurdles that, well, I've got to do this and I got to do this. And it becomes so big.
Right. Everybody does it. Everybody does it.
Procrastination. Yeah.
Yeah. That's why the daily challenge, it breaks all those down. And that's why it works. That's why it's so powerful. Yeah.
I love that. So before we go, I always like to end with a question, but I want to know if your kids stayed in France.
Oh,
so or Eva, if they came back here.
Yeah, my 25-year-old Eva is, she lives in San Francisco.
Okay.
But she's a designer and a filmmaker. So she went into a creative field. And my son is in college and he's in New York. And he passed the French fluency exam that would have allowed him to, he got accepted to the Sorbonne.
Oh,
I don't know if you know this, but university in France is free. Because he demonstrated French fluency, he could have gone free as a French resident. He chose not to. He chose to go to New York City, broke his mom and dad's heart a little bit, but he loves France and will end up there, at least part-time someday.
They're grateful that they are bilingual, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean, for sure. And we all fell in love with the French village and the French lifestyle. Both of, my daughter's a foodie, and it was nothing but beneficial. The only downside was I think we gave the dog a small dose of PTSD when we put him on the plane.
Oh,
that he never really fully recovered from. He's got really terrible separation anxiety.
Oh,
yeah.
Poor
so,
thing.
Which breaks my heart. Absolutely breaks my heart. But other than that, it was nothing but positive.
Yeah. I did have a chance to spend 3 weeks in France when I went to a rugby, I think it was World Cup rugby.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in France. And we stayed in an Airbnb, and it was amazing because we stayed in a really small village, so you really had to interact, but I really don't know a lot of French, but when you're forced to interact with the locals, it really is an amazing experience.
It's lovely.
Uzès, we stayed in Uzès.
Oh sure, that's not far from where we were actually. Our neighbor's daughter lives in Uzès. Beautiful town.
So tell me what, as you're approaching your 60th year and new decade, what are you most excited about?
So I haven't been asked that question yet, and I don't have a prepared answer. So that's good. Let me see. What am I most excited about? So my husband and I became empty nesters just recently. Our son Joe is in his sophomore year, but he did a late January start. So he's only been gone a year. He's been gone just over a year. So we're 1 year into empty nesting. And I have a book coming out in May. Steve has a book coming out in July. I turned 60 in May. I mean, it's a big year, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a big year. What am I most excited about? Honestly, oh gosh, I'm excited about so much. I'm trying to pick a most. I'm so excited about who the young adults our kids are turning into and the time we have been having and are having with them. My husband and I haven't traveled a lot since COVID, partly because we were both heads down working on books and we're both very anxious to do some traveling. And it will be our first time traveling without, four of us traveling, which is a whole different, so it'd be just us again, like when we were newly married. So I guess most excited, but also both of us launching these books means we will both be embarking on sort of our next phase of creative work.
Mm-hmm.
And I
Do you
don't
know what that is?
I don't know exactly. I have ideas. I don't know exactly what that's going to be yet. So if I did know that, that's probably what I would have answered. But because I'm in that hazy, I could do this, I could do that. It's still very hazy, but it's promising, right?
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, those are the things I would pick among. But if I had to pick one, I'd say probably we've been here. We've been home since COVID, and I'm ready to start traveling again.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sure you're anxious for nicer weather with that snowstorm.
Yes. Yeah. I am always. Yes. I know. Spring in Minnesota is my favorite. And some days it's a one day, you know, we just go from winter to summer at like 60 degree temperature change. And Minnesota's the weather is crazy and it happens so fast and so much all at once. And it's so hopeful and it's so, I love spring and it is my favorite season.
Yeah.
And it is just.
Yeah. There's a lot of nature.
Yeah.
It's all waking up.
Yeah.
We live on a golf course and you can see the green just like popping up every day. It gets greener and it gets greener. It's all brown and it just like, it's got this little green film on the top and it's super exciting. Yeah.
We're a couple weeks from that now.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for coming on. And I have no doubt you're going to do something amazing next. It sounds like you're really in tune with all the things that will lead you in the on the path that you're meant to walk. And
Thank you. It
sounds like you have a great partner in this game of life.
I did get lucky there. Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
Thank you. And I can't wait to watch your Instagram or wherever you're
I have to figure out how I'm going to present or how I'm going to. Yeah. So
I can't wait.
I don't have a blog, but I do have a YouTube channel, but I've got to think through it. But I do love the idea.
Keep it simple. Lower the stakes.
Yeah, definitely. Totally. All right.
We're going to
not break the chain.
Don't break the chain. Whatever you do, don't break the chain.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Yeah. Bye-bye.